Earlier this year, Britt Ray logged into a Zoom meeting.
It was a wild webinar, indeed. It was my most entertaining Zoom of the pandemic.
Britt is a science writer who's been researching the psychological impacts of the climate crisis. So she thinks a lot about the mental and emotional sides of climate change, everything from stress to anxiety to denial.
And so I logged into this webinar. There were about 60 people on the call, and it was the end of this 8-hour session they'd had doing whatever annual general meeting things they need to do. And I was there at the end of the day to kind of, you know, I don't know, provide some new thinking and perhaps entertain them at the end of what was probably a really boring meeting.
She was invited to the Zoom to host a sort of virtual fireside chat with a very unlikely audience, a bunch of energy executives. They worked with coal, oil, and gas in Norway.
And so what they invited me to talk about was the psychological impacts that hold us back from addressing the climate crisis in a straightforward way. And I was really grateful for that invitation. It showed, you know, open-mindedness on their part. And I then launched into a 45-minute talk about what denial is like in the climate crisis.
She walked through the basics of climate change denial. Denial, she said to them, and then later to us, is really a spectrum.
There's outright denial, but then there's, which would be the kind of fossil fuel funded denial of the crisis itself that we've seen for so long in this country. But there's also the soft denial that many of us can very quickly whip out, because when things feel intolerable, when they're scary, when they're threatening, we can split the truth off from a reality unconsciously. Often we're not really aware of it.
She explained how there's this idea in psychology called disavowal, which is where you essentially have one eye open to the truth and another closed to the truth at exactly the same time.
For example, maybe you trust climate science and you think climate change is a very serious problem. And at the same time, you don't really adjust your lifestyle.
You know, it's natural. We all need to lie to ourselves a little bit when reality is tough. It helps us get by. But it's kind of a bug in the system when it holds us back from doing the necessary work that is threatening our civilization as a whole.
So she talked about all of that with these energy executives. She read some spicy quotes. And then it was time for the Q&A.
It was just crickets. Silence. I mean, 60 people on the call and yet not one person with a question or a comment. I awkwardly just tread water trying to get some kind of response for them, and it was becoming unbearable for me. It was just so uncomfortable, the stillness, because what I'd said were, you know, it was obviously provocative and it was putting them in the hot seat as an industry, but also trying to do so in a way that acknowledged that they're humans and they are individuals, and you know, they think that I'm sure they are good people and they've got other things to take care of in their life, and they're just trying to take care of their families and do their jobs. And, you know, I wasn't villainizing them as individuals, but I wanted to have an open conversation about the industry at large. And anyway, after a few minutes of that, one person popped up to just say, I think this is really emotional, really difficult for us to hear about all the terrible things that we do. And I was like, oh, wow, okay. Because I was expecting possibly I would get some defensive comments, but this seemed to land in a heavy emotional way. And then another guy spoke up to say, you know, I'm of the age where I'm going to die of old age, but that doesn't bode well for my children who could die of the climate crisis.
The meeting ended after a few more minutes of painful silence, and she's thinking, yikes, this wasn't a great Zoom call. But eventually, she started getting emails from some of the people in that meeting. They told her privately that her talk was interesting, but kind of painful to hear.
One CEO said, my thoughts on the whole situation as a whole is that it's an Armageddon kind of feeling. So I could see that, you know, these ideas had really gotten into their consciousness and they were thinking critically about them rather than just having abject denial pop up. And I thought that was hopeful.
Do you think they're going to have you come back and speak again? Do you think
No way. I do not think so.
Oh. So that oil and gas conference may not want to have her back, but we wanted to talk more with Britt Ray about the emotions we have about climate change.
Climate change is a little scary when you think about it. I mean, don't you think?
Yes. And working on this podcast is also scary. I've been learning so much information and it's like, I don't know what to do with my feelings around this information. And I also feel a little guilty about being an information distributor.
Well, this is a podcast where we usually explore listener questions about climate change. But we're going to do something a little different today because we're going to explore one of our own questions. What do I do with my climate anxiety?
I don't know. From WWNO, WRKF, and PRX, this is Life Raft, your survival guide for a changing planet. I'm Lauren Malera. I'm a comedian, and I was born and raised in New Orleans.
And I'm Travis Lux. I'm an environment reporter for New Orleans Public Radio. And today on the show, mental health and climate change. How do I handle the anxiety? Britt Ray hasn't been talking about climate anxiety for super long. 2017 was the year she had her first big run-in with the feeling. That was when she and her partner started thinking about having a kid.
Because then all of a sudden the responsibility factor was not just this hypothetical. It was like, I'm going to make the decision to bring a kid into this world or not, that every single sign is telling us is going to be a much harder world to live in. And you know, I feel cursed by the information in my head because it would be much more blissful to not be aware of this stuff. I think it really made me contend with, you know, just generally how scary and dark sometimes the future can feel because all of a sudden I was putting myself in the future.
We should say it's not like she wasn't paying attention to the climate before this moment. She has a degree in biology. She had been reading the latest climate studies and had been getting increasingly concerned by her research. But that kid thing, that really threw her for a loop.
That's when it became really an issue of the heart and the gut for me, I'd say. And it moved out of just the headspace. And it was a real difficult, painful process of dealing with new emotions of eco-distress or eco-anxiety. And it really, it motivated me. It motivated me hugely to kind of stop what I was doing, put my attention on this area of how does the looming existential threat of climate change affect our psychologies? If I look in that area, might I find some interesting coping mechanisms that can help us find more agency to actually reduce the problem in the first place?
So that's what she did. She finished up a PhD in science communication and started investigating this overlap of climate change and mental health. She's working on a book about it that won't come out for a while, but in the meantime, she started a newsletter that unpacks some of these same issues. It's called Gen Dread. It comes out once a week, and there's going to be a link to it in our show notes.
So for the rest of the show, we're going to bring you a bit of our conversation with Britt Ray. We talked about a lot with her, tips and tricks for managing climate anxiety, how grief can be helpful, and a lot more. We'll have the rest of our conversation after the break. Okay, so we've kind of been circling around these ideas of climate change anxiety and eco-anxiety without really defining them so far. So, what are they? And how do they compare to other forms of anxiety? Britt broke it down for us.
Yeah. So climate anxiety and eco-anxiety are related terms. Eco-anxiety has been defined by the American Psychological Association as the chronic fear of environmental doom. And climate anxiety is just a climate-specific version of the same kind of stress.
An interesting thing here is that eco-anxiety is not currently listed in the DSM. That's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is basically the Bible of mental health stuff. And Britt says some people want to keep it that way, not in there.
Because What it is actually is a stress response to one's awareness to a very real, unfolding, unprecedented civilizational threat. And it's therefore a moral emotion. It stems from an accurate appraisal of a real danger that's out there, and there's nothing that should be dismissed as, you know, unfounded catastrophic thinking here, which a lot of anxiety disorders are wrapped up in.
She says this makes eco-anxiety very different from a general anxiety disorder, that it isn't anything to pathologize or to try to cure. But she thinks eco-anxiety is still worth exploring because it can show up in our lives in all sorts of ways.
And this can range from something as light as simply feeling worried when you read the news, and going through bouts of, you know, cycles of guilt and shame about your own lifestyle choices and wondering if you should become vegetarian, for example. You start making some lifestyle shifts. Maybe you declare you're never going to go on an airplane again.
For some of us, this feeling might even affect our relationships. If our friends and our family don't seem to be as upset by the climate crisis, for example. And some of us might even find it difficult to function.
It could affect their ability to sleep, their ability to work. They might no longer have any trust in other people, might just generally not feel safe in the world. In some cases, even become suicidal or develop eating disorders by which they kind of try to winnow away their carbon footprint by not eating any food that has a carbon footprint attached to it. So really, it's a sign of connection and feeling the vulnerability of the world itself.
Lauren, do you think that you have ever experienced eco-anxiety? We've been talking about this spectrum. Do you think you fall anywhere in there?
I mean, yes. I'm definitely, for all my bravado, I'm very stressed about New Orleans disappearing some point.
Yeah.
It could happen.
Yeah.
It probably will.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think, you know, we're talking about that idea of disavowal earlier, and I think that, frankly, I fall in that category, you know. Thinking about it, worried about it, making some changes, maybe not enough, you know.
Yeah, but you work in climate change, so you're like, on the weekends, I don't worry about it. The weekends are for me. So I guess it's like the way you've described it, is there any way to know how many people are dealing with it? Because I wouldn't, like, if I read a newspaper article and was stressed, I wouldn't necessarily think, oh, I have eco-anxiety, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is some research being done now. We've got some polls. We've got some really alarming polls, actually. For example, in the United States, a poll that came out earlier this year found that 78% of Gen Zers in the United States say that they're not planning on having kids because of the climate crisis. That's a really strikingly high statistic. And I believe 73% of millennials in the same poll said that climate change has already affected their mental health. It's all like patchwork at this point. We don't have anything for the global temperature on this, but I think that work will be slowly coming together.
So, I don't know what you think the best way to walk through it is, but what are some of the main important tips for people when confronting these feelings?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that brings so much relief to people who are feeling eco-anxious is just to find other people who get it. Who don't interrupt you when you describe your worries about the climate crisis to say, oh, don't be so dire, you're fine, or the sky isn't falling, what are you talking about, you know? People who can really level with you and say, that's okay that you're feeling that, and yeah, let's talk about it. I've interviewed many people who are, you know, on the eco-anxiety spectrum, and they say that this is the most fundamental part of them being able to cope with it because it's still disallowed in our culture at large. We still can't talk about it at the workplace, in our families often, you know, even with our partners or closest friends sometimes. If we're feeling eco-anxious, the lack of mirrored response we get makes us feel more alienated and alone, and that can really just make the whole thing a lot worse to deal with, a lot harder.
One of the things I found really interesting in our conversation with Britt was how much she talked about this idea of grief, like how ecological grief is different from other kinds of grief.
There's just truly so much to worry about, and it seems sort of trivial and a little bit privileged to say, I'm sad about an ice cap. But she explained allowing yourself to feel anxious about these future events can be helpful.
And she explained how when we mourn things in the future, It's this concept called disenfranchised grief.
And this stance is very different from what happens, for example, when you lose someone you love, because then you have, you know, funerals and wakes and Shiva and different cultural rituals that allow you to find the support that you need in what are profoundly disorienting times in your life. But when you're mourning a glacier that is melting beyond a point of no return, or the 3 billion animals that perished in the Australian bushfires last New Year's, then, you know, this becomes a lot harder to talk about because we have no social norms with each other for how to mourn together for these non-human losses. And there's a real power of coming together, taking your private grief and making it public mourning. It can become a political leverage point. For example, let's look at Black Lives Matter and all of the incredible mobilization that comes from something like Say Her Name. You know, coming together and voicing what is not being voiced by the dominant culture at large allows people to bond over their shared emotional struggle and then strategize and mobilize and cause change from there. And what would it mean to do that for non-human loss?
She is right. We don't really have any traditions around grieving the environment, which mm-hmm. we know is dying.
Right. It gets me thinking, you know, we're just mentioning cultural traditions and making private grief public mourning, which I think is something that New Orleans is really good at with its funeral traditions and second lines. And it made me think about what if we had a second line for the climate?
I would be down, especially if we did it around Mardi Gras time. Uh-huh. If you want to join our Mardi Gras crew, email us at liferaftpod. No, but for real, no one would organize it besides us.
Yeah.
And it's very on brand.
Right. That's kind of a good transition to talk about activism, which we did with Britt, because I think there's a lot of us feel like we need to channel our climate stress into activism of some kind, like maybe like as a way of channeling the grief or pushing away the grief or just proving to ourselves that we take this issue seriously. Britt says that activism's great, but she did have some cautionary words about just diving in.
Yeah, so I mean, there has been also a tendency to prescribe activism as a solution to beat the feelings back and get rid of them. And, you know, maybe this isn't surprising because in our culture, we're kind of addicted to positive psychology. We like to feel good and productive and beautiful and great and, you know, all these things. And this kind of low tolerance for feeling blue and down in the dumps. And it's not something we celebrate dealing with together in the same way. So there's been this kind of knee-jerk reaction to, don't worry, you can get rid of your eco-anxiety. Here's how. Do these 5 environmental actions and join a group that is putting pressure on your representatives to take climate action, and then you're going to feel better and fine, and the pain will dissipate. But we know that communities are being harmed right now. You know, people are going to be dying in heat waves. Migration crises will be happening. I mean, there are lots of things to still feel dark about and mourn. So there's real value in not just trying to get rid of the emotion and beat it back with activism, but both, you know, do activism and welcome the dark feelings. They're important as well.
I'm just like thinking of my own personal friends who are like afraid of being shot by the police. How do I be like, hey, you should also worry about the environment? You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And that's true. I mean, when you've got real immediate threats, how are you going to say, oh, yeah, let's prioritize some carbon tax right now when I'm worried about my personal safety or that of my child just walking outside the front door? And that's very real. The thing is that these crises are really not separate. They're part of the exact same problem. The environmental racism that allows communities of color to face higher levels of asthma because their communities have been right next to polluting chemical factories, for example, is caught up in the same kind of general racist system that also breeds police brutality, for example.
I've thought about this a lot, and I've talked to some of my friends about it, and honestly, I prioritize the Black Lives Matter movement ahead of the climate change movement. But I think Britt is right in framing your activism in a more, what's the word, in a more inclusive way. Like, I truly can't care about Black lives if I don't care about the environment that they live in.
Right. There's one more thing I wanted to ask you, I just was remembered of it because we're here at the end of the conversation, and I think I read you hate it when people ask you about hope.
I was being a snarky person that day.
Oh, no, that's
cool.
Fine.
You can ask me about hope.
No. I don't want to ask you about hope. I want to ask you about what you said about that idea, actually, because I thought that was interesting. It sounded like you were saying something about this idea of being hopeful is not necessarily a helpful one or something. You were kind of getting at that point, if I remember correctly. So can you talk about that idea?
Yeah, well, I mean, the hope is such a tricky concept because essentially some people say, if there's no hope, you won't act. Like, hope is the engine for action. If we lose sight of that, then we're just facing complete psychological catastrophe and no one will ever do anything and they'll just stay home and they'll cry on their couch. And other people say, what are you talking about? Why on earth would I need a vision of a hopeful future when that is not what's undergirded resilience? Like, how hopeful does it feel when your people are being threatened? Your entire existence is being threatened and you have to fight through that. You don't act because you are feeling like a rosy future is around the corner. You fight because you must, because you're trying to keep your loved ones safe and you have dignity of yourself to protect. And so when you then act with bravery and courage in that way, then maybe, sure, you create the conditions that allow you to be hopeful, you know?
Okay, so this whole need to be hopeful thing, I totally get that idea and criticism of this idea. I'm also feeling a little bit embarrassed because I should confess in that my years of being an environment reporter, I have definitely tried to emphasize the glimmers of hope in a lot of my stories because, you know, I don't want people to tune out or like throw their earbuds in the trash can.
Yeah, well, I have a confession too.
Yeah.
I also like happy endings.
I've been working with environmental stories for the better part of 10 years in radio and podcasting and stuff like that. And I've faced many editors or seen other people pitch stories to editors or to funders only to be told, hey, that tells a really sad story. We're not going to touch it with a 10-foot pole. Mm-hmm. Why don't you wrap it up at the end with a glimmer of hope and then we'll reconsider it? And you start to see this kind of narrative formula, which can be really disheartening when it feels incomplete or disingenuous or a bit inauthentic, because it's saying that we need to kind of like wrap it up in a bow and say that it's hopeful at the end in order to sell it, in order to work with a human reader or viewer's kind of psychic comfort that they're looking for. And it can make you a little bit worried when you see that pattern again and again.
Yeah. Well, anything else, Lauren, that we haven't asked about?
Well, I mean, this is a kind of personal question. Did you decide to have kids?
Well, we're actually trying now.
Oh.
Cool.
So who knows? Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that was my doorway into the work. Mm-hmm. And for sure, it's been a roller coaster thinking about the various elements. But decided ultimately it's definitely something we don't want to sacrifice just because the future has some scary threats in it, you know. So however people decide is how they decide. But although I'm not completely, it's not like a totally easy decision, I'm excited about it.
Cool.
Yeah, well, build that community.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, we did it. You know, that thing she said that she doesn't like, where you try to end the conversation on a glimmer of hope.
Yeah.
Nice little bow.
I guess it was just, maybe it's the last time. It was just an irresistible, you know, narrative device. It was a question that kind of lingered over the conversation. It was nice to find out some more.
Listen, climate change is scary, but life raft is not. Let's roll the credits.
Let's do it.
Life Raft is a production of WWNO, WRKF, and PRX, and is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
And this episode was produced by me, Travis Lux, and edited by Curtis Fox. The theme music is by Peter Bowling, additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. The logo art is by Laura Sanders, and WWNO's Coastal Desk is supported by the Greater New Orleans Foundation and the Walton Family Foundation.
Our website is liferaftpod.org, and that's where you can also submit a question for us to explore. We also are on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at liferaftpod. Feel free to write us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you like the show, then share it with someone.
There's actually some really interesting resources and support groups that we talked about with Britt. For anyone who wants to plug into a community of people who are also concerned about climate change, there's one called the Good Grief Network, which actually includes this 10-step program modeled a bit after Alcoholics Anonymous.
Don't forget to check out our show notes for all sorts of useful information. We have a link to Britt Ray's newsletter. It's called Gen Dread. And we also have some ways that you can find climate-aware therapists.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. It's so dumb. It's just like feel good fun. It's like, well, you could say bye-bye weird. Okay.